You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Nationals reporter, Jamal Collier. And Jamal, I guess first of all, before we get into the hot stove season and awards week, it's good to have you on the podcast. We did this throughout last year with Bill Ladson, but he's kind of gone on to cover this game at a more national level, and it's great to have you on the podcast for 2016 and then into 2017.
Thanks a lot. I'm happy to be here and excited to get started and get going here with what should be a pretty interesting offseason for the Nationals.
Yeah, certainly should be a team that looks to kind of add some pieces to get over the hump and finally get it into the World Series. Nobody's been busier, though, during this awards week than the Nationals. When you think about Dusty Baker finishes third in Manager of the Year, Turner finishes second in Rookie of the Year. And then on Wednesday night, Max Scherzer breaks through and wins the National League Cy Young win. He's the sixth player to win the award in both leagues. And maybe the best announcement in the history of these awards, Jamal. Max Scherzer on a boat somewhere. I'm not sure where. I don't know if you know where. But on a boat, obviously enjoying his offseason and on Skype. And he gets the award and he gets sprayed with champagne. And it was just a lot of fun to watch on MLB Network.
Yeah, Max is one of the most interesting guys to watch in baseball for me, and it's kind of a pleasure to watch him every day kind of go about his business because he's so intense and he enjoys it and works so hard about things. And he's just that kind of odd and eccentricities to him where you see stuff like, you know, I was wondering why is his Wi-Fi so bad? His connection seems to be off here on MLB Network. And then I find out he's in the middle of the ocean. Around the British Virgin Islands, you know, he's around a trip with some of his college buddies, and they said the trip that they do every off season around this time, where they all get together and not necessarily just kind of celebrate each other and, you know, hang out with their wives and everything. And it just so happened that it was during the Cy Young Award announcement. So it's kind of a spontaneous thing where they were out, you know, on this boat, and Max is a big scuba diving fan as well. So, you know, really, it was a cool moment to be able to see him celebrate a guy who's also won a Cy Young before, to see how much it means to him to win a second one. I think that's the kind of things that you'd like to see in baseball.
Yeah, and he beats out, obviously, a couple of Cubs to get it, Lester and Hendricks. And it seemed like Scherzer was maybe the throwback candidate as far as numbers go. He had the win total. He had the big 20 strikeout game. Maybe he had the bigger moments. And I don't know if the Cubs guys split the vote a little bit, but if you were one of the voters, did you like Scherzer's chances to win the Cy Young over those two guys?
Yeah, I didn't have a Cy Young Award vote. I had a Rookie of the Year, but I would have voted for Max had I had a Cy Young Award vote. And not necessarily just the wins and the strikeouts definitely were there, but I put a lot of credit into things like innings. And Max led the league in innings there, so he shouldered a big workload to keep, you know, the bullpen fresh and keep the Nationals into things like that. He had a high strike, the best strikeout to walk ratio. His Ks per nine was, you know, right there top of the league, the highest pitcher WAR. He just had a lot of numbers, and the strikeouts really is what drove everything there. And you know, it's such a thing in this kind of era of the game where the strikeouts are obviously up, but where you can just simply beat the hitter by yourself, and you don't necessarily need other factors, I think is really important. I think the Cubs did split the vote a little bit. I think there's probably some credit to that, because Max kind of won the vote pretty handily there, which it kind of looked like it was going to be a closer race. But, yeah, I think Max definitely – he didn't benefit also from just the historic defense that the Cubs pitchers kind of had. The Cubs obviously played a tremendous defense all season long. The Nationals are probably somewhere around average as far as defensively. So for Max to just go out there and strike guys out at the rate that he did, I thought was really important, and I thought it was a well-deserved award.
One more Writers Association award coming up on Thursday night. That and Daniel Murphy is one of the finalists for the National League MVP. Chris Bryant also in there, along with Corey Seager. So Murphy kind of the grizzled veteran of the group against the youngsters. But how about the fact that just last offseason, the Nationals went out and they bring in Daniel Murphy. He just overcame all possible expectations in 2016, didn't he?
I mean, there's just no chance that they thought when they were signing this guy that he'd be a finalist for the MVP award at this point. And they're gladly take it. He was so tremendous for them and for so many guys in their lineup to be pretty inconsistent. I mean, we look at the struggles that Bryce Harper had. Ryan Zimmerman never got going. Anthony Rendon had a tough first half. Trey Turner didn't come up until the second half of the year. The one constant, really maybe alongside Wilson Ramos, who of course then got hurt for the last month, but the one constant the whole way was Daniel Murphy. And he just hit every single thing. He hit for power. He hit for average. He hit running his corner position. He slugged. He did everything that they could have asked for him. And became just a fixture in the middle of the order. And proved that what he did in the postseason in 2015 was no fluke. And he really kind of just built off that. Has made himself into one of the best hitters in the National League, if not the majors as well. So it's really impressive. He's got an uphill battle to try to win this award against Bryant. Who, of course, also has the defense to go along. And that's, of course, where Daniel still struggles a little bit. But just really the performance he put on offensively this season was just kind of a joy to watch, and something the Nationals certainly would take this year. Certainly are glad they got it this year, I should say.
Yeah, awards week closes the book kind of on the 2016 season. So we look ahead to 2017. This Nationals team, there'll be high expectations again. I would think they'll – if not the favorite in the National League East, they'll be right there along with the Mets, depending on what the two teams do here in the offseason. You mentioned Wilson Ramos getting hurt, and obviously he's a free agent, and with the knee injury, seems more likely to be a better fit in an AL team, maybe. We'll see. But when you look at this Nationals team and what's needed, what does this team need to add to take that next step to get into a World Series? What stands out to you as the biggest holes?
The weird thing about the Nationals in this season is that, they obviously have had these three first-round exits. And, last year, but they're, in the past couple of years, you could point to, okay, maybe there's a huge bullpen thing, or maybe there's a hidden hit or whatever. And this year, there's not really a huge glaring hole. They don't necessarily lose a whole lot. Wilson Ramos obviously was an important piece. They don't lose Mark Melanson at the back end of the bullpen, but they traded for him midseason anyway. So it's kind of an odd thing where you've got a team that's not really broken, but yet you kind of need to do something to try to get over that hump. My biggest thing, I think that they could use maybe another bat in their lineup somewhere. I talked about a little bit, how Daniel Murphy was the one guy that hit all year, and you had other guys kind of, up and down and a little bit inconsistent. And necessarily you're not sure if you're going to get more of the same from some of those guys, or it's kind of weird to say you're not sure what Bryce Harper is anymore, but is Bryce Harper really the MVP guy, or is he somewhere closer to what he was last season? So I think they could benefit a lot from a bat somewhere in the middle of the order. I think that would probably come somewhere in the outfield. If you get a corner outfielder, you can move Bryce Harper to center field and, move Trey Turner to his natural position at shortstop. And, of course, with Jason Wirth, his contract is done after this season, so you have some flexibility with your outfielders if you sign somebody or trade for somebody that has some couple years left on his deal. But I think that would just be a huge upgrade for them. They can put somebody else in the middle of the order alongside Murphy, alongside Harper and Rendon, and just really have a kind of formidable, two, three, four, five, or three, four, five, however you want to line it up. With Trey Turner at the top, I think that is going to be a huge boost for them. They're going to make a play as well for a closer. Depends on how the market kind of sets up and who, kind of how pricey things get. But, they'll take a run probably at Aroldis Chapman, at Melanson, and at Kelly Jansen. So that'll be interesting to see how things play out there. But those are kind of the biggest things that we'll have to do to try to figure out, do we make a big move here and kind of not necessarily blow this thing up, but shake things up a little bit? Or do we just kind of improve around the margins and say we got a good squad and we're going to take another shot at this thing next year?
You talk about those closers, and Mark Melanson, obviously a relationship with the club after finishing the season, and Dusty Baker with a relationship with Aroldis Chapman being his manager in Cincinnati. So there's at least some connections there that maybe you can kind of use to help lure one of those guys back to help out that back end. I think having Trey Turner in that lineup all year is certainly going to help this club as well. They've made one key move here. Well, key move. That Chris Heisey is returning. A one-year, $1.4 million deal. He's a guy that seems to just be one of those bench guys that's a good fit in this team, and it makes sense to just bring a guy like that back.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was kind of a little bit of a surprise, I think, when they brought him in last offseason, minor league deal, made the team out of spring training. You're entirely sure exactly what he would do. And as far as a pinch hit bat off the bench, to come in and basically hit you a home run, he was perfect. And And he filled that role extremely well. He played fine filling in all three outfield positions at some point. And they really just like the things they can do with him. They don't have a whole lot of right-handed, bats off the bench anyway. And Chris was just kind of the perfect role to get a couple of bats a week. He was able to keep himself prepared and keep himself ready. To when his name was called, he was able to kind of produce and hit some big home runs for them this year. So it was a perfect fit, and I'm sure he really seemed to like Washington as well, and kind of got his family and everybody adjusted. His kid was always running around the clubhouse, so he seemed to enjoy it as well. I think it was just kind of an easy call probably for both sides to say, hey, we like what you did here. It was a good fit. And I think he was comfortable as well with the team and with the role, and obviously with Dusty Baker. And I think those things just all kind of came together that, and they got this thing done quickly.
All right, one more question for you, Jamal. They've already made some moves, obviously. You hear a lot of rumors swirling early in the offseason, but it seems like things always really get going with the winter meetings in early December. The Nationals are kind of the home team this year for the winter meetings. They'll take place in D.C. Going into the winter meetings each year, what is Mike Rizzo and company, what's the approach for this team when they go into a winter meetings?
Rizzo is just such an interesting general manager to me, because even when there is not a clear, necessarily a need or a clear hole, he's able to fill those with our needs or our holes. But even when there's not something that's apparent, he's willing to get creative, willing to do things to try to improve his team. And we saw that with Max Scherzer, where they signed him and it looked like they had a starting rotation that was set. And he said, hey, we can get better with this guy in our rotation, and we're going to go out and get him. And I think that's the kind of thing with Rizzo, is that he's so open to any kind of combination that even though it may seem like, well, you have this or you have that, and you shouldn't even kind of consider things, he's willing to think outside the box a little bit, just on everything. So, he talked a little about at the GM meetings a couple of weeks ago at this point, or maybe last week. I forget what day it is really right now. But he talked just a little about laying the groundwork, about some potential deals, about some potential things. You've heard some of the names flying around about McCutcheon or about Chris Sale or about just some of the bigger names there. And I think the Nationals are going to be aggressive and going to play in all those guys and see exactly what the market looks like. And if there is an opening and there is something they feel comfortable doing, I think they're definitely going to take advantage. So that's the biggest thing for me with Rizzo, is that there's not really a guy who you can say, the Nationals wouldn't be interested in him. Because if he does improve the team or does the team better, I think they'd sign him and then kind of figure out what to do with him, later on once the season starts.
This has been MLB.com Extras, our Nationals edition. For Jamal Collier, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.
I think the obvious place we have to start here is Yoenis Cespedes. We'll get to Neil Walker as well, but Cespedes obviously declines the qualifying offer. He's a free agent. The Mets still very much want to bring him back. It seems like the money is going to be big, and they're not going to be able to do what they did last year, kind of wait it out. They got to get in on this early. How quickly does Cespedes, do you think, Anthony, make a decision? And is this something that moves quickly, or will it take some time in the hot stove?
Well, I think it's going to take a little bit of time, only because he's one of the biggest guys out there this year. And whenever that's the case, these guys tend to linger, tend to see what the offers are going to be. I think it's different than last offseason, and that the Mets are going to be more aggressive than they were. But I also think it's kind of the same in that other teams' interest will dictate their own interest. Because if his market goes up here, the Mets are going to be out. If his market stays down here, they're going to be in.
No, I agree with you. And the one thing that I thought the Mets did a great job of, Sandy Alders and John Rico, their group there, was monitoring the marketplace for them for Cespedes. I think that's always been a strength of theirs. But when you're in that market, you don't want to bid against yourself, certainly. But they had a good feel for what was going on with other teams, and the interest wasn't as high because there are other guys out there in the free agent market. Now, he's the guy out there, so it changes it a little bit, and there's five other teams besides the Mets that could be interested, but they really haven't stated how or the level of interest, which makes it a little trickier.
What about those other teams? Because you can tell teams are definitely going to be lining up for a guy like this. Where are the best fits? We saw a year ago the Nationals went out and got Daniel Murphy from the Mets. They seem like they're definitely one of the teams involved.
Yeah, I think the Nationals are going to be involved. I think the Giants, when all is said and done, are going to be involved. But honestly, I think the Mets are the best fit.
Right.
Not necessarily financially, because they don't have a stomach for that $100-plus million contract, but on the field, they need that bat in the middle of their lineup the lineup is not nearly as scary without him as it is with him. And I think when you just look at the teams and what their needs are throughout baseball, I think the Mets, baseball-wise, offensively, they're the best fit.
They're the best fit. You know, Toronto could be a fit, again, you know, depending on if they can't get Encarnacion. Dodgers could be a fit if they don't re-sign Turner. Like, there's a lot of ifs, right? Turner, St. Louis could be a fit to move him to left field because they lost Matt Holliday. So there's a lot of those type, but, you know, even Houston has said that they were going to spend money too. But some of those teams need a center fielder. Cespedes has said he really doesn't want to play center field. So I think that's the other tricky part, is if you do go down that road like the Nationals, then who plays center field? You know, does Turner move to short and they move Harper to center field? Can they convince Cespedes to play there for 1 year? There's a lot of other moving parts. It doesn't seem like it's as good of a fit than in New York.
And let's not forget that last year the Mets signed Cespedes fully believing that he would play, or at least expecting him to play center field, and he did for half a year. But I don't think he's going to necessarily convince anyone that he's a center fielder in a long-term deal now after what happened.
So is it who does play center field if he returns to the Mets? Who's that guy?
For the Mets, I think you got to put Curtis Granderson here for one more year, and it's not an ideal situation. Certainly, he's diminished from what he was earlier in his career as a center fielder, but he's essentially what you've got. You're not going to make a Jay Bruce switch positions. You're not going to have Juan Lagares play full-time or anything
Conforto,
like that.
You know, that's ill-advised to put him out in center field, even though they talked about him maybe playing center field. I think you're right. Grandy's got to be the guy.
Yeah, and then you readdress it a year from now when Granderson's a free agent.
Where are they going to trade Bruce, assuming it happens? Where does he go?
Well, I think there's a couple teams. Toronto was kicking the tires on him last year when the Mets ended up getting him. The Angels, although they filled that spot, they could use a left-handed bat. The Orioles need a left-handed bat. It's kind of the same group of teams that are interested in Josh Reddick and Michael Saunders, who are free agents. You know, the Giants could go down that road from a left-handed bat side of things. So I think there are plenty of teams that would – listen, Jay Bruce, even though he struggled as a Met on occasion, this guy still hit 30 home runs and has been an all-star. So I think there'll be enough interest, and I think they could free themselves up from the money. I don't know if they'll get a guy like Dilson Herrera, you know, like they did last year, but I think that they'd be able to move him.
Well, you talk about a Granderson, too. I think Jay Bruce just has a lot more trade value at this point. He's coming off a very good season overall. And yes, he didn't do with the Mets what people wanted him to do, but you can't just discount the last 9 years of his career for one mediocre half season.
Speaking of other needs, or maybe needs, because you hear about the news about Jairys Familia pleading not guilty to charge of simple assault. He was arrested back October 31st. There's a chance that he may end up having to miss some time because of that, obviously. It's something the Mets need to prepare for. Now, is there a possibility the Mets go out free agent market and bring in a big-name reliever?
I don't think they're going to bring in one of the big three closers. I don't think they're going to have the financial appetite to do that. I don't think they're going to want to deliver one of those long-term deals. If you're talking about who closes on opening day if Jairys Familia is suspended, I think it's going to be Addison Reed, who's a good option, coming off a great year, really a better year than Familia in a lot of ways. I do think they will be active in free agency in terms of relievers, but if you're talking about an Aroldis Chapman or a Kenley Jansen or a Mark Melanson, I don't think they're going down that road.
No, I agree. I think Brad Ziegler is a guy they could go down. There's been a report out there, Boone Logan, the left-hander we saw, his former Yankee. Jerry Blevins could come back. It's that group of guys. Even a Fernando Salas, I believe, is out there as a free agent. That type of guy, that veteran-type guy, is where I expect them to be shopping.
Yeah, and that's what Sandy Alderson loves to do, right? He brings a lot of guys into camp and lets them compete and sees how it shakes out. He doesn't love to invest huge money in those high-end bullpen pieces.
What's the status on David Wright now as he start the offseason? And obviously, tons of question marks around David Wright.
Yeah, he's in a little bit of a holding pattern right now. He's still waiting for more clearance from the doctors. And this is going to be an ongoing thing throughout the winter. He's going to gradually progress. But he has said all along that he expects to be a normal player in spring training. He expects to come to spring training coming off that surgery and be, you know, what you could expect him to be. Now, what is that at this point in his career? Age 34, really hasn't played a full healthy season in about a half decade now. No one knows. I don't know. I don't think David Wright knows. And recently he has begun to start to admit that, hey, you know, the thought of me going out there and being an all-star caliber performer probably isn't realistic. Right. But can I go out there and play 110, 120 games? Not to put a number on it, but can I be productive in my own way? Yeah, I think he's very hopeful he can do that. I think the Mets are very hopeful he can do that. And look, they're going into this season with David Wright as their starting third baseman, but they're also going in, as they did a year ago, with an insurance policy. This year it's going to be Jose Reyes. He's there, and especially if Neil Walker comes back, that's going to be big because that'll free Jose Reyes up to bounce around second base, third base, even shortstop if he needs to. And I think just given the status of David Wright, you need that guy.
You know, Wright's interesting too because, you know, you talked about it in his ability to play third base, or would it be less strenuous to play first base? He's going to need time off and rest. And, you know, in that balance that he went through this year, it was hard for him mentally, but he's starting to figure that out until he re-injured himself. So it's going to go back down that road. I think we like to put numbers on it, right? And we like to put 100, 110. And I know in the front office, you try to put numbers on it. It's such a wild card that you almost have to look and say, well, geez, if we got half of a year production out of him, we got 81 games out of it, you know, and he stayed healthy for most of the year, I'd feel good about it and like to have his presence around. You got the protection, as you mentioned, with Reyes and Duda over at first. And so that one is really, really tricky. You just hope that you have enough depth. And they do. They, you know, they have guys that played a big part, like T.J. Rivera as an example, and maybe even Flores as a part-time player. So we'll wait and see. But I think they have some other guys to kind of give them protection.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting also that David Wright has been asked about moving over to first base, and his answer is pretty much the same always. Is, look, it's getting up to play the games that's the issue. Yeah. I don't think first base is really any less strenuous on my body than third base is. So a position move at this point of his career, very unlikely.
Neil Walker, one of two players to accept his qualifying offer here heading into the 2016-2017 offseason. He'll return to the Mets, $17.2 million. Seems like a good situation. He's obviously coming off the injury. One big year, he'll be back on the market, and it solves a problem for the Mets.
Well, it solves a huge problem for the Mets. Listen, in 113 games, this guy was one of the most productive second baseman in the game, and you know he made improvements from the right side as well. 820 OPS overall, and I think that this is a guy, if you're the Mets, you're sticking him in the middle of the lineup. He's 20 plus, maybe even 25 home runs, maybe more than 80 to 85 runs batted in if they get some help ahead of him. This is a huge deal, I think, for the Mets, especially to have him on a one-year deal.
If the Mets are going to be successful again in 2017, obviously the pitching has to be there. They patched it together, there's no question. But they also learned a lot about some young guys late in the season. If the entire rotation is healthy, meaning Wheeler, Harvey, Mats, DeGrom, and Thor, if those guys are all back, where do Lugo and Gesellman fit in? Do they go to the minor leagues or do they go to the bullpen?
I think there's a decent chance you see probably one of those guys, at least one of them in the minor leagues to start. There's also a decent chance you see one or both of them in the bullpen. I know that's kind of a always answer, but it depends how it shakes out in spring training. I don't think you're going to go out and see the Mets really acquire starting pitching depth this winter. You know, they love what Lugo and Gesellman gave them this year, and I think had they advanced deeper into the playoffs, you would have seen Gesellman be a big part of that. Certainly Lugo would have been a big part of that. But look, to say all five of those guys are going to be completely healthy, going into the season, maybe. But throughout the season, no, it doesn't happen for any team, even with a rotation that doesn't have as many question marks as the Mets. So having those guys is key. I think that's a big reason why the Mets were not content, but all right with letting Bartolo Colon walk to Atlanta. And I think you're going to see Robert Gesellman and Seth Lugo both start games for the Mets at some point this season.
There's no doubt. I mean, you're right on. And I think that's how they have to build their rotation and really build up their depth is, you know, a lot of it depends on who they bring in as free agent relief pitchers. Sure. And how they pitch in the spring. You know, you're going to have the most depth. You want the most depth that you can coming out of spring training. So there's a possibility both of them could end up in the minor leagues, stretching their arms out. You can always bring them up into the bullpen later. Likelihood, as you mentioned, you're going to need them at some point for the starting rotation. That's where losing Colon really hurts them because he was the one certainty that you had. You knew the likelihood he was going to give you 175, 180 innings. You couldn't pay him what the Braves did, but you know that versatility that you had with Colon, it really hurts not having him, but I think you're protected a little bit with Lugo and Gesellman.
One bit of news we have gotten as far as the rotation goes is that Noah Syndergaard isn't going to have surgery to remove that bone spur, which seems to be maybe it was a little more was made out of it during the season than needed to be. In fact, Sandy Alderson, I think his quote was, it was blown out of proportion during the season, which tends to happen with the Mets. I think that was his. I love how Sandy takes these things and just kind of rolls with them, has fun with them. But that was the case. It's not a big deal, apparently.
Yeah, and in Sandy's defense, he and Noah Syndergaard said from day one that this wasn't a big deal. And I think a large portion of the reason why people freaked out over it a little bit was because Steven Matz, at the same time, was going through a much bigger bone spur and dealing with that. That was obviously causing him a lot of pain. Now, he had his removed, but I think it kind of created this buzzword, bone spur, that you think about. And, you know, you start talking about bone spurs and everyone gets all worried that Noah Syndergaard has one too. A lot of pitchers have bone spurs. You know, you've seen medical reports over the years on players. If you look at an X-ray or an MRI of any pitcher out there, they're going to have something going on for the most part. So certainly great news for the Mets that it's not something that needs to be operated on for Noah Syndergaard. But I don't think it was ever, as Sandy Alderson said, a huge, huge deal.
The only hesitation that I had on it, and you know, I believed him to some degree, but remember when Harvey came up and we didn't really think there was anything much going on in the elbow, and then all of a sudden they said it's Tommy John surgery. You're like, out of nowhere. So you're a little skeptical on that front, but that one start that he had right before the All-Star break, Syndergaard did, where he lost almost his entire velocity. He was throwing like 90 miles an hour. You're like, oh, what was that? Like, never see it in the game, right? And so I think that was always kind of sitting there in the back of your head, like, okay, is that creeping up and causing the issue? I think it was more fatigue than anything else. And obviously, like you said, good news. And you know, let's hope it doesn't bother him next year, which I wouldn't think. If it was bothering him enough, they would have gone in there and just, you know, cleaned it up and taken it out, and he didn't even need that.
And look, the thing with Syndergaard, you hate to say it out loud, but he's the only one of those guys who has not had a Tommy John surgery. And considering how hard he throws, considering the consistent velocity with which he throws and all of that, yeah, this isn't wood, but you can knock on it if you're a Mets fan. Right. It's something you have to have in the back of your mind, planning-wise, as a team, that, hey, this is something that could happen. It may never happen, but it could.
All right, this has been a lot of fun. For Jim Duquette and Anthony DiComo, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time we're on here.
Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Braves reporter Mark Bowman. And Mark, nobody's been busier early in the offseason than the Atlanta Braves. Already have made some moves, and obviously already plenty of rumors about moves they still may make. We'll get into that a little bit and what they could do. I want to start, though, with what they've already done, and that's sign a couple of starting pitchers nearing the end of their careers, but guys that the Braves hope can still be effective, and two guys that you would think at the minimum are going to give them plenty of innings, which could be really valuable for this young team. So let's start there. R.A. Dickey, Bartolo Colon, they come to Atlanta. Colon is interesting because he's a guy who has been with the Mets, has been in the division, and it seems like he's a guy that just wanted to keep starting and not go into a situation where he was pitching in somebody's bullpen.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we started, when I first heard Bartolo's name, probably early October, probably before the wild card game, because I remember being there for the wild card game, just kind of asking around about Bartolo. What do you guys think? You think he would leave New York? You know, he lives in Jersey. He had, grown quite comfortable with the Mets. But the fact of the matter is, we don't know exactly what kind of opportunity he's going to have there to pitch in that within that rotation again next year with the emergence of, you know, some of their young guys that, you know, he just made what guarantees to be in any rotation, but there was much more of an opportunity for him to come to Atlanta and chase that record that he would like to get the 11 more wins to have the most wins of any Dominican-born pitcher. I think that's very important to him, as was the long relationship he's had with John Hart. John Hart was there the day that Bartolo signed his first professional contract in the Dominican back in 1993. Here we are almost 25 years later, and these two guys are being reunited. And, I talked to John Hart here earlier, and he said, you know, it's not just about the relationship we've had. It's not just about that record, but he said that Bartolo likes a lot about where the direction this club's going. You know, he made a point to say he really likes the way Dansby Swanson plays, and you know, any pitcher, that's obviously important to have that kind of defense that Dansby provides. Also, you know, staying strong up the middle. You look at what endurance Arte provides coming off a Gold Glove season. So I think that Bartolo found that there was a lot to like here in Atlanta, and he and R.A. Dickey both did exactly what the Braves wanted, was in that it's just a short-term bridge, one-year deals that will not block their prospects that they'll be coming to Atlanta within the next couple of years.
Cologne had a great season in 2016. Dickey not as solid. Is there a belief, though, that there's still enough in the tank there with R.A. and the fact that he does throw the knuckleball?
Yeah, and I think they looked at August. You know, August, Dickey, I believe he made 5 starts. 4 of those were pretty good starts. They got to September. You have to question, well, if he was that good, then why didn't they give him more than 2 starts in September? I get that. Look, he's not the guy that won the Cy Young Award a few years ago. But at the same time, he is somebody that, you know, I know that the 200 innings has been thrown a lot, around a lot. He doesn't have to come in here and throw 200. But if he comes in, throws 180, proves to be serviceable on the mound, and provides that positive influence that he always has to young pitchers, that then, you know, the Braves are definitely going to get their money's worth out of that contract. And the same goes with Cologne. I mean, I've heard so many good things from former teammates, you know, pitchers and position players alike, who just say, you know, this is a guy who just makes your clubhouse better. And, you know, as you said, you know, Cologne's coming off a pretty good year, no matter what age you are, you know. And obviously at 43, he still has that ability to spot that two-seamer. You know, he's maybe back 10, 15 years ago, he doesn't have that velo that he has, but this is a guy that's just always known how to pitch. And he can teach some of these kids who still have that ability, to that luxury of having velo, that, hey, look, that's not your primary weapon. You have to learn how to, if you learn how to command, you know, that just makes your velocity that much better. It's not the velocity that makes you better. That's just an extra benefit once you are able to gain consistent command.
So Dickey and Cologne, two guys to help the team in 2017 and help some of those young guys, like you said, and help when probably some of those young guys are going to have innings limits and things like that. Now, the rumors that are swirling around this Braves team go beyond 2017. When you talk about names like Chris Sale, Chris Archer, Sonny Gray, these are guys that would be a focal point for this team as they hope to get back to contention. It would be at the top of that rotation for what I would think the Braves would hope to be their return to the postseason at some point. How likely is it that this team could pull off one of these, a big trade for one of these big pitchers?
I'd say, here's what I would say to that. Is it your likelihood? I don't even want to put it at 50%, but at the same time, I'm not going to say it's an impossibility. Yeah, you know, you look, they've done their due diligence with all of these guys, with Sonny Gray, Chris Sale, Chris Archer. Those are your primary names. Obviously, you have to ask if the White Sox are also willing to trade Quintana. And then, you know, you do your due diligence. The fact of the matter is this. They are very reluctant to move their prospects. But if you have the chance to get a guy like Chris Sale, you know, you definitely jump at that opportunity, especially when you can control him for 3 years at basically the same amount that you're going to pay, the same salary you're going to pay Bartolo Colon this year. You know, long before Charlie Morton signed his 2-year, $14 million deal this week, we knew how expensive pitching is. But that provides that reminder that, you know, not only, you know, if you can go and get a guy like Chris Sale, not only are you getting possibly the a guy you put in top, one of the top 5 pitchers in the game, but you'd also be getting him at quite economically. So, you know, at the same time, when you say that, you have to remember the White Sox have to ask themselves, you know, do we really want to get rid of this guy? Because they do have the pieces to win. So it's not like I truly believe the White Sox when they say that there are not hard feelings from last year. Some of the incidents that happened with him being disgruntled with management, I think that they realize that, you know, they have an important decision to make. Now, if they end up trading one of these guys, I think they have to trade them all and begin a full rebuild. But at the same time, they're the ones with the leverage, because they do not have to move a Chris Sale right now. And the same with the A's, and the A's with Gray, and the same with the Rays with Archer. So they're all in good position, because this is a weak free agent market in terms of pitching. So they all saw what the Braves did with what was Shelby Miller last year, and you know, you got to you know, I mean, it's easy to understand why they at least want to go and see what they can get for their own guys.
I'm sure the Shelby Miller trade comes up in conversations among these teams when they're talking about these kind of trades, Mark, as well. One hole that we talked about even middle of last year was the catcher spot for this Braves team and what would happen. And there's obviously been talk along the way about Brian McCann coming back from New York, obviously being a longtime Brave and a fan favorite. That seems kind of unlikely. But now you hear maybe Jason Castro's name. He's a free agent out there. There's a few other guys. Wilson Ramos with the injury, maybe not a good fit. Where are the Braves looking as far as adding a catcher? And do they feel like they have to add a catcher?
I think here's how, you know, they said it best last week when they said that pitching is a need, catching is a want. So, it, you know, while there's a chance that they add a catcher, that they do not view that as a necessity. They could go into next year with Tyler Flowers and Anthony Recker as their catchers. You know, I think that they want to, you know, exhaust any possibility of adding to this rotation. You know, you can evaluate both situations concurrently, but I don't think that their focus is on catching right now. I think that, you know, for the right deal, if something could be done with Castro, yeah, maybe they could do something before the winter meetings. But this may be a conversation we're having in D.C. in a couple of weeks. When those meetings begin, you know, will they go get a catcher? Just because they don't necessarily see that they absolutely need one, with the catching market being relatively – it's an interesting one just because you've got Matt Weider sitting there. The Braves have never shown any interest in him. As you said, Wilson Ramos, the Braves definitely would have been interested in him, but it had he not suffered the ACL tear during the last week. Now he's a guy that, you know, I don't see it happening. I mean, I'll throw this number out here. I don't see them signing him for more than 1 year. You know, $5 to $7 million. He's going to get more than that. And you know, so now you're down to the Castros, and there's a lot of teams that are interested in Jason Castro for the Braves. He's a good fit because he would be, you know, left-handed hitting complement for two Tyler Flowers, two highly cerebral guys that handle the pitching staff really well, and you know, you could try to take advantage of their strengths by platooning them, using that left-right platoon there.
All right, one more question for you, Mark, and that is, you mentioned the winter meetings, and obviously the Braves have already checked off a lot of boxes on their shopping list for the offseason. But when you think about going into Washington, D.C. in the winter meetings in early December, and going into a winter meetings in general with Hart and Coppolello, what is their normal approach from the last couple of years that you've seen entering the winter meetings?
Well, I mean, it is very aggressive. You know, it's certainly the part of the rebuilding phase that they're in has changed significantly from 2 years ago. We started to see them transition a little bit last year during the winter meetings with the Shelby Miller trade that landed them in Ciarte and Dansby Swanson, Aaron Blair. You started to see, hey, look, this is not a team that's just unloading now. You know, not only, you know, now they're moving pieces and brightening their future from a more immediate standpoint. So I think that, you know, this year, John Coppolella, he goes a mile a minute, 365 days a year. So, and the good thing is John Hart is that guy that is there to kind of harness some of that aggression. So I do expect that, you know, leading up to the winter meetings and during the winter meetings, you know, we'll be talking a lot about the Braves, especially if the Sales, Archers, and Grays of this world are still available, because, you know, they'll exhaust any and every, you know, ounce of effort to try to get somebody just to improve. This is, you know, you can look and say, you know, they went and got all these young pitchers. What are they doing with the Matt Whistlers and Aaron Blairs? These guys are going to pitch. Guys will get hurt in the rotation. Plus, you know, going out and adding pieces, you know, it never hurts to add to your depth, nor does it hurt to provide some motivation to these young guys that, hey, look, nothing's guaranteed. You're going to have to fight for a spot at the big league level or, you know, go back down there to AAA and continue your development until we have a spot for you. So, you know, I think that if they had to go to spring training right now with this rotation, with the Dickey and Cologne, Folty, Teron, and then you determine whether you've got Whistler or Blair in your fifth spot, you know, they'll be happy. But at the same time, I think what Kopp has shown is he does not leave any stone unturned. He says that a lot, and his actions certainly verify back up that statement.
Great stuff, Mark. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Braves edition. For Mark Bowman, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Phillies reporter, Todd Zalecki. The offseason is upon us, the hot stove season, and the Phillies have been busy early on. We'll get into Howie Kendrick. We'll talk about some other moves they've made, what the goals are as far as what they can add to this team during the offseason. But, Todd, we got to start with Jeremy Hellickson, who decided to accept the qualifying offer. So it'll be 1 year back with the Phillies for $17.2 million. I guess my first question for you is, would the Phillies have preferred to get that first-round draft pick rather than have Hellickson on the roster in 2017?
Yeah, I think that would have been their preference. Of course, you know, they're going to say they're happy to have him back. And certainly, there's no harm in having him back. He was a very productive pitcher for them last season, and they can still trade him before next season's July 31st trade deadline. But when they made him that qualifying offer, I think they fully expected him to decline it and sign a multi-year contract with another team and then get that first-round draft pick. In fact, that's kind of what they were holding out for during the previous, this past July's trade deadline. They were looking for talent. When they talked to teams, they were looking for talent kind of commensurate with what they would get if you rejected the qualifying offer. So I think that's what they were hoping for. I believe that they would have been fine going forward with a bunch of young starting pitchers, namely Nola, Eichhoff, Velasquez, Thompson, Asher, Eflin, you know, that whole group, going forward with them through in the 2017 season. But again, having Jeremy Hellickson makes the rotation better, and they can still trade him at the upcoming trade deadline in July.
Yeah, and now knowing how this worked out, I think they'll probably be a little more motivated to get that done this July. How about from his standpoint, are you surprised at all? Just because when you look at the market out there for starting pitchers, I mean, beyond Rich Hill, I think Jeremy Hellickson's probably the next best guy that could have been available. Granted, he would have had that pick attached to him, which a lot of teams would have maybe paused before maybe making a move, but I would think a really good multi-year deal was available for him if he really wanted it, if he wanted to turn down that qualifying offer.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When I talked to him yesterday about it, he basically said, yeah, you know, early last week when they offered it to me, I was leaning towards declining it, but in the last couple of days, Scott Boras is his agent. He said basically, Scott said, you know, a lot of teams are interested, but they also said they're really reluctant to give up that first-round draft pick, and which is understandable. So I think in Jeremy's mind, he's confident that he's healthy, and because he is healthy, he believes he had the success that he had last season. And so he doesn't really look at it as a huge gamble. In other words, he's going to make $17.2 million next year. He believes he can replicate that success, and if he can replicate that success, he's going to have a longer track record for teams to look at. So instead of having one good year, you know, kind of a bounce back year, they're going to say, "Wow, he did it 2 years in a row." And with the CBA possibly changing next year, there might not be that first round draft pick attached to him. So I think he's looking at it as a gamble, but as a good gamble to make on himself.
Yeah, you mentioned if the CBA changes, maybe no pick. And also, if the Phillies do trade him, there wouldn't be a pick either for whatever team they trade him to. So definitely, I think, a better chance that he wouldn't have that pick attached to him, which would, I think, expand the amount of teams that would be interested in him in a year. And hey, $17.2 million for a year's work, it's not bad if you can get it. All right, moving on. Howie Kendrick, the Phillies have gone out and gotten him for Darren Ruff and Darnell Sweeney. Kendrick's a guy that for most of his career, Todd, was an infielder, but he kind of showed that he can be an effective outfielder as well. When the Phillies look at him, where do they see him playing, or does that kind of depend on what happens around the rest of the roster?
Well, going, I mean, as of today, you know, if they would kind of remain status quo, he's going to be their everyday left fielder. You know, certainly he came up as a second baseman. There was some kind of real small talk that Cesar Hernandez could be on the market. I talked to Matt Klentak last week about this. He said, we are not looking to trade Cesar Hernandez. He's coming off a great season and even greater second half. So right now the plan is to have Howie Kendrick play left field, but he certainly does give them some flexibility. And they like this move because of that flexibility. Because for this reason, you know, they're going to have to add a bunch of guys to the 40-man roster on Friday. So they're going to have a lot less flexibility this year in terms of calling guys up, bringing guys down, you know, kind of that back and forth that you have with some kind of like those quote-unquote 4A players, et cetera. So they really need guys that they know can play every day or almost every day, and they can plug into certain positions should there be an injury. So now that they have Howie Kendrick, they know he can play every day in left field, and if something should happen to Cesar Hernandez, an injury at second base, they know he can move there. If something should happen to Michael Franco at third, they think he can play a little bit there. He's also played some first base. If something should happen to Tommy Joseph, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why they like this move, and they think he's a candidate for a bounce back. His batting average of balls in play last year was his lowest mark in years, so they think that if he bounces back to his regular numbers, his production will go back up, and they think that he will help out their offense last year, next season, which was the worst in baseball this year.
You mentioned that bad offense, and I know Pete McCannon late in the year talked about the need to add bats to this team going forward into 2017. Is Kendrick enough, or are they going to be active as far as bringing in a free agent bat?
Well, you know, I really think that this is probably going to be it in terms of the big bat. You know, not that he's necessarily a big bat, but he's a everyday player that they certainly needed. And I say that because now that you have Kendrick in left field, again, assuming that, you know, nobody else is traded or whatever, you have Odubel Herrera in center field, and now you have vacancy in right field. Now, if they were to go out and find somebody else, a free agent or whatever, pretty much right field is the only place you could play him. I mean, you know, maybe you could find somebody to play first base along with Tommy Joseph, but really second, short, third, catcher are all tied up. So it doesn't really make sense at this point to go out and find a player that's going to have regular playing time in right field, because the Phillies want to see, you know, is Aaron Altherr going to turn it around? Is he worth holding on to? You know, Roman Quinn, you know, Nick Williams, one of their top prospects, he could be up at some point. Dylan Cousins, another one of their top prospects, could be up at some point. So they actually want to have a place for these guys to play semi-regularly. And if you sign another bat, like I said, most likely it would go in right field, and that would kind of put the kibosh and all that stuff. So for that reason, I think if they do bring in another bat, it would be more of the fifth outfielder variety, a guy that maybe could pinch hit a little bit, maybe hit a home run on occasion.
The winter meetings last year in December in Nashville, the Phillies were active in the Rule 5 draft as far as bringing in players. Todd, now it seems like they're kind of going to go the other way beyond the defensive, because they have a lot of young talent, and obviously a lot of these guys need to be protected, or there's the fear that other teams could sweep in and grab some guys. Is that the biggest thing behind the release of Matt Harrison this week?
Yeah, it absolutely is. You know, the Phillies got Matt Harrison that Cole Hamels trade in July of 2015. He was basically salary relief for the Rangers for taking on the remainder of Hamels' deal. He was injured at the time. The Phillies had no expectations he would pitch. Sure enough, you know, he never pitched because of a chronic back injury. But, yeah, the timing definitely coincides with the deadline Friday that the Phillies have to place their Rule 5 draft eligible prospects on the 40-man roster, otherwise risk losing them. So by releasing Harrison, they now have 32 players on the 40-man roster. And then, you know, they actually have probably more than eight players they could protect. I mean, that's a list that includes Nick Williams, Dylan Cousins, who we just talked about, Mark Appel, Andrew Knapp, top catching prospect, pitching prospects like Ricardo Pinto, Nick Pivetta, Ben Lively, Alberto Torrado, you know, and other position player prospects like Andrew Pullen and Jesmiel Valentin. So they have, you know, and that's just arguably the top guys on the list. There's other guys on that list, too, that they could protect. So they have a bunch of players that they, you know, you want to have as much flexibility as possible and protect as many players as you want to protect. And so by getting rid of Harrison, by releasing him, you at least you give yourself another option in terms of, you know, saving that one prospect. Because the Phillies are in a tough spot. You know all these guys aren't going to hit, right? You know all these prospects aren't going to pan out. But you don't really know which ones aren't going to pan out and which ones are going to pan out. So you don't want to, like, keep Matt Harrison on the roster or keep an extra guy on the roster, only protect seven, and then that eighth guy is the one that you're, like, borderline. You don't protect him. He gets picked, and then that person turns out to be a superstar, and you end up kicking yourself for the next 15 years.
Yeah, that's not good, because those are the kinds of things that fans remember as well every time they see that guy out there on the field. Hey, we had that guy at one point. One more thing I wanted to touch on with you, Todd, is the closer position. Genmar Gomez didn't really get it done for the Phillies. They added Pat Neshek, so that's a little bullpen depth already with the trade with the Astros. But do they need to add a late-inning guy? And that said, I'm assuming we're not talking about Kenley Jansen, Aroldis Chapman, or Mark Melancon.
Right, yeah, those guys you could definitely scratch off the list. But, yeah, I agree with you. I think they need to go out and get on the back end of the bullpen piece for the same reason that they liked Howie Kendrick. Because they're going to have such little roster flexibility because after adding all these Rule 5 guys, they need a guy that they know can go out there next season and in some way, shape, or form pitch effectively in the 7th, 8th, 9th inning. So, I mean, names that I've kind of thrown out there, Joe Blanton, who pitched great for the Dodgers last season, you know, not necessarily a closer, but somebody that they could throw in the 7th, 8th, 9th inning if needed. You know, teams that are, I mentioned Sergio Garcia, Sergio Romo as a possibility. You know, looking at teams that might go after Jansen or Chapman, you know, and if those teams sign a top-notch closer, then some of their own free agent relief pitchers might trickle down, and the Phillies might take a run at them. But if I think internally speaking, Hector Neris would be a really good closing option. He was their setup guy last year and was really dominant at times. He's got the great splitter. And I think personally, going into spring training, unless they go out and they get a Romo or whatever, that type of guy, I think Neris will kind of enter camp as the favorite to be the closer, although I don't think they're going to come out and say that. You know, I guess Gomez will have the opportunity to keep his job, but certainly it's far from a guarantee that Gomez will be in that spot. And in fact, if I had to put money on it right now, I would say that Hector Neris will be the closer on opening day 2017.
All right. It's certainly going to be an interesting offseason for the Philadelphia Phillies. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Phillies edition. For Todd Zielecki, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Marlins reporter, Joe Frisaro. And, Joe, you look at this offseason for the Marlins, and obviously I think the thing that they're zeroed in on as far as adding to this team has to be pitching, which isn't necessarily a strength of this marketplace this offseason, especially when you think about starters' availability. And you lost another one on Monday, Jeremy Hellickson deciding to accept the qualifying offer from the Philadelphia Phillies, so he's not on the market as well. So what is kind of the, from what you've heard or what you kind of guess at, what is the Marlins' plan for the approach of this offseason and how they can kind of fill these needs?
Yeah, Tim, there's going to be a challenge. You know, they're kind of one of those teams that kind of want to be in it, but might be a little short on overall depth and talent and, you know, are kind of, you know, figuring out which direction to go. You know, they've been consistently saying they want to keep the core. They think that their core eight can compete with anybody. But as you noted, you know, the pitching is a drop-off and a concern, and especially in light of, you know, the passing of Jose Fernandez, who meant so much, you know, not only to the, you know, just the energy and excitement he brought to the team, but obviously his all-star production. And they just don't have a lot of pitching depth, you know, behind, you know, in the system and coming up or even on the rotation. They dealt with injuries
and they're seeing it's a huge challenge to try to figure out which direction to go in terms of acquiring, you know, what they would hope to be is controllable pitching. As you noted, Hellickson, he's a guy who they approached the Phillies, you know, before the trade deadline back in July, the 1st of August, and, you know, the asking price was very high back then, and we saw what Jeremy just, you know, accepted the $17.2 million qualifying offer to stay in Philly. You know, you got a Rich Hills out there, but I'm not sure, you know, they want to spend those dollars for the age and the injury risk. So they're kind of in a bind. You know, are they going to peel off the core, you know, move an Ozuna, you know, or an Echevarria? And then if they do, then they're, you know, subtracting the quality they have in their everyday lineup. And how do they replenish that? So, you know, I think they're kind of asking themselves and monitoring, you know, how to go with this, you know, with, you know, and moving forward to kind of strengthen a weakness and, you know, stay competitive at the same time.
So that's mostly as far as the starters go. As far as the bullpen goes, they declined the option on Fernando Rodney, which I guess makes a lot of sense as far as the dollars and having 1 year left of him. Do they also need to go out and add some bullpen arms and depth?
Well, let's start with Fernando to start with. I mean, he had the $2 million club option, which I think they may have even considered picking up, except for the bonuses he made, you know, mainly because of his really strong first half with the – you know, with the Padres, and when he was an all-star, you know, with bonuses, it pushed his salary up to about $5 million. And, you know, at that dollar figure, considering he's turning 40, you know, they just, that didn't make sense to retain him at that figure. So that's why he's a free agent. And, you know, you could approach it a second way. If you can't, you know, if you could kind of load up on durable starters that can get you 5-6 innings, get you 180 innings, then try to make your bullpen, which kind of was a strength this past year, even stronger, and go pursue, you know, bullpen arms in mass, you know, then that's one way that they could contend as well. But again, you know, it's, you know, how many dollars are you going to throw at some guys? Melanson, Chapman, and Kenley Jansen are the three big closers out there. All are going to get big money, and all are, you know, coming from playoff teams. Chapman, in his case, winning a World Series. Plus, there always seemed to be kind of that feeling you could go back to the Yankees, and indications I'm hearing is I wouldn't be surprised if that's where he ends up. Jansen has a, you know, even though he declined the qualifying offer, he comes, you know, now with a draft pick, and the Marlins, on top of having to sign him, would forfeit the 14th overall pick in the draft, and they're not really, in, you know, depth-wise wanting to part with, you know, a draft pick. Melanson, I think he was what interviewing or, you know, meeting with like the Giants and teams like that. So to get somebody like that to want to come to a team that's trying to move forward with question marks is going to be difficult. So they're going to, but there is more bullpen depth out there. And then I think we saw in the playoff teams doing a little bit more creativity with their bullpens. Obviously you can't go 2+ innings with your best relievers every day, you know, every game over 162, but you know, you can compile depth and create, you know, that way of shortening games in the back end and hope your starters consistently give you 5-6 innings.
You mentioned the core, and obviously it's a solid group of young players with this Marlins team, but there's some, I guess, as far as depth goes, that's another place where they need to add something. And there's some guys that they had, obviously Jeff Francoeur, Chris Johnson, Jeff Mathis, those guys are all free agents. Would they like to bring one or a couple of those guys back beyond going out and getting somebody else that's a free agent?
I think Jeff Mathis is the most logical. You know, he's really found a home here. He works really well with the pitching staff. He's not going to cost a lot. You know, I think he's, the last couple of years has been going on like a $1.5 million. You know, so to get that caliber catch and throw catcher, who has also been, you know, credited for the development of JT Realmuto. You know, so I think he's the most logical. You know, Francoeur, you know, could make sense. You know, when Frenchie came here, he kind of noted, even though a lot of people, I think, assumed he was going to flip and go right back to Atlanta when the season ended. But, you know, at the time, the Marlins looked like they were advancing to being a really solid playoff contender. Obviously, they made their run in 16, but have the core in place to, you know, take it another notch up in 17. I think he wanted part of it. But if this team is looking either stagnant or, you know, not being a contending situation, Francoeur, who noted he'd like to play for a team having a chance to compete, he may go seek other options. And Atlanta's made a lot of, strong moves. They're very aggressive, and they got a core that's really good, or at least a young core. It looks like they could turn things around pretty fast in Atlanta. So it's going to be interesting. But those are the two I would think are the most realistic. Could come back. Mathis probably for sure. Francoeur, I think they would like him. But part of that also could be, what they do with Ozuna. If he stays, there's less need, for him. If he goes, if he's moved in a trade, then, maybe – Frenchie comes back and splits time somewhere in the outfield.
One more thing I wanted to get your take on, Joe, is there's been talk, I think, this week of the Marlins actually coming up with a permanent memorial of sorts for Jose Fernandez. No real details on what that might be, statue outside the ballpark or anything like that. I know the temporary memorial that was set up after his death continues to be there and continues to get visitors. How quickly do you think the team would try to put something more formal together and pay tribute to Jose Fernandez?
For what I'm gathered, this is owner Jeffrey Loria's kind of pet project. They've kind of made it clear that they were going to do something, for Jose and his memory and his legacy, and what exactly that's going to be. It's still, is still in development. Where it will be as well. None of those details, but I would imagine before, the World Baseball Classic, if one of the rounds is in Marlin Park, if possibly then, if not, certainly by opening day. And obviously you got the 2017 All-Star Game here in Miami. I'm sure they'd want to have something in place, before that, because, Jose's memory and legacy are certainly going to be a topic as, this season, as the 17 season comes about. But, it's something that Jeffrey Loria is doing, and I think in time, once they have final details, they'll kind of give a little better indication of what that is. But to no one's surprise, they're going to do something, like you said, whether it's a statue, whether, I kind of suggested, that pitching mound that kind of was, where he was, 29-2 in his career, to retire that and have, maybe have that somewhere in the park. And that might even be something that they're considering doing something, with, the mound or, some parts of the mound as well. But we'll actually, in time, see what they do to honor and remember Jose.
And, of course, everybody remembers the team going out to that mound in that first game after Jose's death as well, and kind of kneeling down in front of it as well, all the players in that game. All right, great stuff as always, Joe. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Marlins edition. For Joe Fusaro, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.